Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Mr. Justin Robert Young. Wish I said Brian because he was drinking as I said that. Oh, I missed my chance.
Saving Brian because he was drinking. Drinking on the job. Yet again, Brushwood, that's two demerits.
You know what's funny is I knew it was a gamble. The moment I picked up the cup and brought it to my face, I was like, I totally bet that Andrew's going to call me out as I'm doing it. And then the fact that you didn't, I was like, what a sweet gesture. And then Andrew made a whole bit about how he wished he had screwed me over.
That's Brian Brushwood you hear. Say hello, Brian.
God dang it. You got me. All right, good. Well done, sir. Went back for a second. That was my victory lap, and then it was a bad idea.
This is why we do this show, folks. So I got a lot of awesome stuff to share with you, and I've got a fun mystery for you guys. But first, I'm going to indulge me in going over some things I did this week because I had a pretty cool Weird Things kind of week.
Awesome. Walk us through it, man.
So my buddy was in town from Florida, Captain Loogie, who you may have heard from other stories. He's a kind of an interesting guy, Chris. He was I met him when he was a park ranger. He and his dad will do things like remove like large wild animals from places, like giant snakes, things like that. And he's kind of a Fort Lauderdale fixture. But anyhow, he was
just,
in town
just
for
so
a couple.
Everybody knows this dude is. I always said that he was effectively a character out of a Florida fiction, like a Carl Hiaasen novel. And then eventually he became an actual character in a Florida fiction novel. And I can't remember the book offhand, but he befriended
Tom Dorsey put him in one of his books.
Yeah, so. Tom Dorsey put him in one of his put a character inspired by him in one of his novels. He literally has never had a job that is not Fort Lauderdale.
That's
he
amazing.
He lives on a houseboat. Like, he has worked as, like, a cabana boy, a park ranger, a bartender. He has exclusively Fort Lauderdale jobs.
First mate on a water taxi.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Water taxi operator.
They were going to – a developer was going to uproot a historic tree in Fort Lauderdale. And Chris is not like – he may look like a tree hugger, but he's not. But he got upset about that tree. Then all of a sudden, you know, everybody thinks he's, you know, he's the the hippie tree hugger, but he stood up for that. He's a neat guy. But yeah, so Chris is in town for a couple of days. And so we only had – I'm here from like Tuesday to Thursday. And I figured I'd give him the whirlwind tour of L.A. And I pick him up at the airport. And I'm thinking, you know, it'd be really cool. And, you know, one of our hobbies we do in Fort Lauderdale is we'd go take a walk along Fort Lauderdale Beach and go a couple miles from one end to the other, free-ranging conversations. And so a lot of stuff we talk about is a lot of Weird Things stuff too. Hop into the car. I drive south of the airport, and we pass the Tesla factory, right? And there, okay. You see Tesla on the top of the roof. It's pretty cool. Get off the freeway, go down the road, and there is the SpaceX factory, okay? Our first stop is just there, like, you know, just to take a look at the factory. I'm like, this is cool. He's into this. So we take a look at the factory and say, let's drive around the block. We drive around, and it's a huge, huge, huge facility. We come around the other side of the block, and there are two flatbed trailers in the middle of the road. And then we drive up, and there's an open gate, and there's a bunch of security guards, and the back door is open, and we can peer inside of the SpaceX factory. And what do we see but a Dragon capsule wrapped in plastic getting ready to be moved onto the trucks and transported to some launch facility?
Man, that's one of those things where it's like, on the one hand, it's like, you know, there's the cynical part of me that wants to say, well, what did you expect to see? You went to a rocket factory and you saw rockets. But then there's another part of me that is just like, holy sweet Jeebus.
I didn't expect the back door to be open and we could see a rocket.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Or specifically a giant piece of maybe the most important bit of history in mankind taking to the stars, and you saw it with your own stupid eyes.
Like, you could go to Willy Wonka's factory and you could take a look at the pink painted out exterior walls. But it's another thing if a window is open and you can faintly hear the
oompa.
Exactly.
Oompa.
That's exactly oompa. What I was thinking. Man, that's precisely. Awesome. So
that was a really cool. And I turned to Chris. I'm like, listen, you're not even here for 30 minutes. I've already shown you a spaceship destined for the stars. So, after that, we went to did a few other sites. I took him to the Vasquez Rocks, which I took Justin to yesterday, which are the Star Trek rocks where they shot the classic arena episode. Pretty awesome.
Was it Gorn? Is that what it was?
Yep. Yeah. We fought the Gorn. And then we went to the the Griffith Observatory, which is a fantastic thing, a sight to see in L.A. They're open till 10 o'clock on weeknights, which is pretty awesome. You can see the planetarium shows. And we go downstairs, and this observatory was – the planetarium was built like in the 1930s. And about 10 years ago, they excavated the lawn in front of it. If you ever seen the Rocketeer at the end with the Nazi blimp and all that, and that old school observatory planetarium, that's it. Well, they excavated the front lawn and they built an entire underground museum below it. And I've been there once since that was built and had no idea that was there.
Ha!
This time I go underneath it and they've got the Leonard Nimoy Theater there. They've got some other things.
Oh, wow.
But this was this is the point I'm getting to is like you can always learn new things. And I'm gonna profess some ignorance here. They have this display where they show your weight on different planets, and it's like this sort of like tile that you can stand on. It's separated from other ones, and it tells you how much you would weigh on different worlds. And I walked on a couple different ones where I'm like, I think this is broken. And I kind of said this in sort of a loud voice, like, looks like they need to fix this, right? And then I started thinking about it. I'm like, no, maybe it wasn't broken. And I went home, and I looked some stuff up, and I had a realization, an epiphany that I have to admit that in all my years, I never really put the two and two things together and go, oh. So I'm going to ask you just off the top of your head, like, Brian, how much would you think you would weigh on, let's say, Mars?
I know Mars is, and again, like Mars is an easy one because I read the Red Mars, Green Mars, Blue Mars trilogy. And I'm going to say it's like what, probably a little more than half what I weigh. Is that right? Like 60%? So I'd weigh about 90 pounds or maybe – no, I'm sorry. 0.4. That's what it is. So I would weigh roughly 60 pounds.
Yeah, that's correct, sir. Okay.
Nailed it.
How much would you weigh on, let's say, Saturn?
Oh, see? Man, you thought you were real smart with that Mars stuff, didn't you? Back at you.
All right.
What you got on this Saturn stuff, Brian?
Right. Now, well, I know Jupiter is the one where everything's like crazy, like 60, 70 times as much. So on Saturn, slightly
less. That'd
be really
great if this were a Jupiter question, Brian.
I'm going to guess. Let's see. I'm about $1.50 here on planet Earth. So on Saturn, let's say 50 times as much on Saturn. I'm going to guess 1,500 times 5, 10,000 pounds. Is that right?
Okay, now here's the thing. Now, this is not a trick question. We're assuming there's some sort of floating barge skimming the atmosphere kind of thing. Okay? You know, so like when you see that where the yellow ends and space begins right there, there's a floating barge and you're standing on top of it. I thought like you thought, Brian.
Oh, good. I'm so glad that
I'm
wrong.
I'm there and I stand on the Saturn thing and I look at this. I'm like, this is wrong. This is clearly wrong because like you, I'm looking at what is the mass of Saturn.
Right.
Totally forgetting the law of inverse squares.
Oh, because it's so big, you are farther out from it. Is
now,
that
Brian,
what it is?
How much do you weigh right now? Just
$1.50. 150. Just call it 150. I'm working on that.
Before the 19-hour bike ride, he's going to go after publicly admitting his weight
on
the
live stream.
That's right.
Saturn?
What's it? Say it again.
Ready for your weight on Saturn?
Yeah.
159 pounds.
No.
Remember,
you just Saturn is so
big.
Bomb
dropped on you, Brian.
That mass is spread apart there. So remember, like it loses, you know, every every meter half, you know, the distance.
So it's, you're saying because it is not dense and rocky the way mm-hmm. our planet is, instead very spread out, if yeah. you could stand at the border of where, give or take, the planet ceases and mm-hmm. and space begins, it would be the equivalent of stand, you know, being way the heck yeah. up and away on planet Earth.
Exactly. If you condensed it to the size of Earth, then you would have this massive thousands of pounds weight, okay? And that's what blew my mind. I'm like, holy cow. And so, because I got fascinated because I was curious, like, how much would I weigh on Titan? And I started looking up from there and thinking, like, oh, well, at this size and all this.
But then, what is Titan, by the way? Because I am so in love. Titan's my new favorite planetoid in the entire solar system. The fact so that it's got Titan. I mean, the fact that they have weather, that they have rain and I guess snow, I don't know, and just everything just not with water.
Let me pull it up. So, but anyhow, so
I'd be a 20-hour bike ride if Brian was on Saturn. Those extra couple pounds, man.
I know, I'd freak out, man. You're like, so, I rode to California.
So much heavier on Saturn. It's like an extra 9
so
pounds.
So your weight on Titan, Brian, 17 pounds, 18 pounds. Call it roughly 18 pounds.
Oh, my God. Wow. So that's
it's
wow.
a full day on the bike.
So here's where it gets really interesting, all right? So all now right. we're looking at that, and if we calculate, you take your weight. So Brian, who is 150 pounds on Earth, you would weigh, now on Jupiter, how ready for how much you'd weigh on Jupiter?
See, and again, like my brain wants to say like 10,000 kilos or some crap.
354 pounds.
What?
Yeah, fatty.
All right.
We See, put finally, that's where I belong. Apparently, my brain is on Jupiter, and that's where
Jupiter.
That's where
you've
I perceive
Jupiter
myself.
Brain.
Exactly.
We put you on Uranus, 133 pounds.
All right. Whoa,
Neptune,
lighter.
168 pounds. You'd hardly notice. Okay. Now this is where it gets really, 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 really kind of curious to me. Is we talk about terraforming planets, right?
Sure.
You would weigh more on Mercury than on Mars.
No. Stop stop saying those words. Okay. No, how can that be though? Mercury is the smallest of the cool planets.
Denser.
Holy cow. I guess cuz the whole thing's like giant molten lead.
You know, it's just
iron.
Deeper. There's just more to it. Yeah.
I like the early planets more than the later ones. You know, when
I really think that they got away from the complexity of the early planets.
You would weigh, but only a tiny difference. Like you would weigh 56.7 pounds versus 56.5 pounds on Mars.
Wow.
On the moon, you'd weigh 25 pounds.
Okay. I believe that.
Yeah. All right.
Venus, care to guess what you would weigh on Venus?
Oh, I know this. In fact, I'll let Justin go.
No.
Okay.
Have you not seen how the three man weave works on this? Andrew asks questions, you answer them. I make vaguely hip hop references.
Okay, fine. I'm going to say I weigh 150 pounds.
Close. 136.
Booyakasha!
So, of all the planets, the ones that would come closest to your actual weight would be roughly Venus or Saturn. Saturn being a gas giant is kind of hard, but, you know, we could build barges there. And you start thinking that, you know, the one planet that really – that it would be really hard to get up in the morning is Jupiter, but it's not outside the realm of possibility.
So, number one, this is maybe the best factoid I've received in the last, like, 3 weeks or whatever, which only makes me think of another mind-blowing factoid that I was not prepared for, and I don't know how we never ran across this. If you're an alien species and what you want to do is find a planet and steal all of its water.
Tell me what you want, what you really, really
want. Your gut would say, come to Earth. We're right. floating in this stuff.
As
right?
all the sci-fi novels say.
Yeah, exactly. That's half the that was the plot of V, right?
Mm-hmm. I still think they're our friends.
If you're the aliens from Signs, yeah.
Yeah, and then in which case you probably, why did you come to Earth? We're covered in
really
water.
Really dumb.
Also, what kind of biology evolves around water being poisonous?
Mm.
In fact, like the infographic that I saw was basically, here's the planet Earth. Here's how much of that is water as a sphere. Here's the moon, Europa. here's how much of that is water as a sphere. Europa has more water than our entire stupid planet. How amazing is that?
It is. Well, here is the thing. So we believe that to be true, except there's now evidence that there is at least an ocean's worth of water dissolved within our crust.
Oh wow! All right, so this is all. This is all.
That's what I'm talking about. Deep dish.
Yeah. But, oh, y'all cutting off the crust. You're missing all the water.
But we'll say of avail. Yeah, I agree. But like, when I saw that thing too, that totally made me. You know, because we've talked before about Europa, and I think we've mentioned this a couple times, like how much water's there. I you know, as soon as I looked at this, I'm like, man, you know, like the weight. Like I'm like, well, geez, if we weigh this much on Venus. Well, I started looking up before the show how to colonize Venus. And there are a couple problems.
Yeah, okay. I would imagine. Let's see. First of all, the fact that there's
lay out all the pros and cons.
Pros and cons. All right.
Venus.
Number one.
Go.
All right. Let's start with the pros. Venus, roughly the size of Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Comparable. You know, your bones will stay dense because you'll be walking in an Earth-like gravity.
Right. All right. I'm liking that. I'm strutting. I got my Saturday Night Fever strut.
You have a little bit more bounce on you.
Yeah, little bit of a little bounce. You got tectonic activity. You got, I assume, some kind of spinning core. Maybe a magnetic shield. Do we know if they have a magnetic shield? Do they have a spinning core?
It's not really got much of a magnetic shield.
All right, I forget I said that.
Spinners.
Pretty much, that's the end of the upside. Downside.
All right. Sulfuric. Listen, lay it on me straight.
Downside is the sulfuric acid.
Wait a minute. Wait, before you get into it, I want to add another pro. Venus, kind of a cool place to say you're from.
Yeah.
Like, oh, where are you from? Earth. Oh, whatever. I'm sorry. I'm just chilling out in Venus.
That's right. Plus, think about for the rising hip hop culture, all the things they could rhyme with Venus.
Oh, good God. Yeah.
Can't think of anything.
It's, so downside, little bit of sulfuric acid as the atmosphere, little bit of 500 degree hot enough to melt lead atmosphere.
All right, tell me something that isn't true in L.A. and Florida, respectively.
I'll tell you what it makes me think of is there was a moment in I'm going back to the Mars trilogy where they sort of warm up Mars by having a soleta, which is a arrangement of mirrors designed to take, you know, because Mars is far out there. So you got these giant space mirrors that sort of focus the energy of the sun. So that if you're standing on the surface of Mars, you look up, and instead of being like a pinpoint or a very bright star, the sun looks the way it looks here on planet Earth, right, as a whole thing. And this causes a whole, like, environmental discussion, like, oh, we're destroying Mars, and there's a fight over the whole thing. When they solve it, the party that – minor spoilers if you're going to read this sci-fi book, which most of you won't – they decide –
most of you ignoramuses won't.
somebody sends
–
they send the soleta away, and as an extra little kind of cherry on top, when they send the soleta away, they send it on a course that will land it to block some of the Earth's energy onto it. Basically, it goes from being a focuser of the sun's energy to a giant umbrella to shield part of Venus to send the symbolic message that, hey, man, we use this to get us where we are on Mars. There are other worlds than these, gunslinger, and and off they go. So that's what pops into my mind.
So you've got this really poisonous atmosphere. It's all like carbon dioxide. There's like no oxygen and you need water. So other than that, you know, we could say it's a fixer upper. But there's one really big problem that I realized a technical problem. Do you know how long
it's
a
big
is
problem when it's something more than poisonous gas at 500 degree temperature?
Do you know how long a day is on Venus?
Oh, that's right. That's why the weather's so crazy, is because it's like forever. Is it tidally locked? Is that with the sun?
It's not quite, but it's like 200 days or something. Earth
days.
So that's the thing you would need is some sort of spin. I mean, you could, there's like they talk, what you mentioned is one thought is like if you put a bunch of solar mirrors and stuff there, and then you could try to do that. Gets to be a lot of work. So, you know, if it's one thing like, oh, it spins nice. If it had a magnetosphere, that's great. All we needed was to fix the atmosphere. Done. I'll get on it tomorrow. But it's just, you know, too massive and too slow moving for that. But other than that, the gravity would be great.
Somebody was saying
it's also where all the women are.
All the ladies. You know, I hear women are from there.
Yeah.
According to a book title I read once. In
written
the
by the former chauffeur for Doug Henning and his wife.
Oh my God, is that really what it is?
That's how they met. He was John Gray's Doug Henning chauffeur.
That's amazing.
And that's the woman's, Barbara DeAndres, that was Doug Henning's wife.
There was somebody, I wish I could remember the
that
details.
That dude might have actually been from Mars, though. Like, that. If it's a literal description of Doug Henning and his wife, that might actually be literally true.
I forget who it was, but somebody was saying that for terraforming or for colonizing opportunities, he heavily was betting on Venus over Mars, which surprised me. And I wish I could find the facts to back that up, but somebody out there is looking on the internet now.
Yeah, you just need to do, like, the problem is just Mars, you know, we can use existing technology right now to build something that human habitat there. Venus is like, it's hard enough to keep probes from melting.
So what do you say to people who are like, stop even talking about colonizing Mars? It's not going to happen. There's no magnetosphere. Therefore, everyone there will die. Like, is there a backup to that? Why the case for colonizing Mars over digging tunnels and asteroids like we've talked about before?
I think that... One is you don't have to spin up Mars to create gravity. I'm a big believer in, like, I think asteroids would be the bigger sort of area for that. But I think the idea is that Mars is that you start at one point on Mars, you start with Mars and digging tunnels, and then you get up to building atmosphere, and then you get up to the building of you know, you're going to get to the point where you know solving some of these problems, and the idea that over a several hundred year scale you make Mars habitable, but you have to start at some point. And that, well, that it is,
and I guess my flip on that would be, we already built the biosphere too. You know, we already built, you know, terrariums and places for butterflies and birds or whatever. Like, we could do that today, right now on Mars without having to learn a lot, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's smaller problems where it gets hairy details, but we don't need new physics to figure these things out. We just need to advance the technologies we have. So I think that, you know, we look at that as it's a solvable problem. And one of the reasons that people, like, there's like some, oh, we should go to the moon first. Well, trying to do the moon is a big, complicated problem, and it would delay getting to Mars. And there was a really good podcast that was on Friday, and it was Gwynne Shotwell, who is the president of and COO of SpaceX, was talking about the longer term goals of SpaceX, and part of, like, their focus is on, you know, Mars, and the next generation of vehicles that they are creating, that SpaceX is building, are specifically for the purpose of the colonization of Mars. This is the head of a company that is worth billions of dollars, that is handling government contracts, is a reliable partner with NASA, leading technology company, has says, yes, and part of our mission statement is the colonization of Mars.
Which, I mean, like, how crazy, like, it ain't like it's like somebody else's, like, pet project. It ain't like, you know, like Larry or Sergey or, you know, Tim Cook or somebody's like, oh, so I'm funding this other thing. And, like, you know, like, we would hope to get to Mars, or Bezos, you know, like, we hope to get to Mars at some point. It's like, no. Here's a company. We have been incredibly successful up to this point. And, like, the projection, if the company is to succeed, it will be because we achieved our goals of going to Mars.
Yeah. I think it's pretty awesome. And it just,
with rockets.
But I think that part of the attraction of Mars is that Mars could be a, if you're looking to have a home that's familiar in some ways, then Mars is the place to start with that. And there's going to be a certain amount of technological.
You know, it's interesting that you put it that way, because I think there's a definite value to the fact that, there's the issue of what we could do and what culturally we're prepared to do. For example, mm-hmm. if we're going to make a space arc and spend, 15, 20 generations to get to some other, you know, chunk of the galaxy to colonize, then while you're on the way, if you're going to spend so much time in zero G – it would make more sense to genetically modify your children to have, you know, four sets of arms instead of legs, because legs are dumb in zero G or whatever, you know, or to, you know, shear up the bones to make them stronger or whatever. But culturally, that's an abhorrent idea. And that, yeah, that
we're,
horrifies
we're
us.
Yeah, we're never going to do that as a species. You know, some cult might do that.
But
you know?
But my point is that logically, by the numbers, burrowing into a bunch of asteroids and virtualizing much of our existence is what makes a lot of sense to get us off this planet. But culturally, I don't think we're ready for that. I think we would feel like, you know, we're not destined to be mole people.
Yeah, I think that you're not, it's not going to start with a let's colonize asteroids project. It won't start like that.
Right.
It's going to start with, you're going to do like many of your boom towns and places like that, which then themselves are not destinations people want to end up in. You go there because there's resources, and then maybe you end up creating kind of a nice place to live, like Las Vegas or whatever. And you know, I was looking up some statistics last night because I was kind of curious, like, what are our most massive construction projects? And the biggest things we build that are moving are, of course, like our cargo container ships. The biggest ship there is a natural gas liquefaction plant that's going to just sit off the coast of Australia. Maersk, you know, one of the biggest, like, cargo movers in the world, they just started having 20 ships built that are about 1,300 feet long and like 200 feet across. 20 ships like that.
All right, hold on. 200 feet across is almost a football field wide, and 1,300 feet is like almost a quarter mile long.
Yeah, and they have like 20 of those things.
So basically, you picture basically you're talking about a ship the size of most high school football fields, right? About that, picture the track around it. It's certainly a quarter mile all the way around. A football field.
Then you got to unfold it. So,
so even bigger than your high school football auditorium.
Yeah, and so then another cruise.
So like a high school football field in Texas.
Then another line has a fleet of 35 ships that are like 1,100 feet long and like 250 feet across. And I started thinking, like, if you were building these in space and attaching them and building rings, you could have a ring with, you know, a mile circumference and 1,000 feet across, right? You could have that. If you put that metal in space, you could build your space thing. Now, of course,
when you talk about, and it seems like such an obvious thing, like, yeah, spin some stuff around, create artificial gravity, but like, if you've ever ridden the gravitron at your local county fair, you know that the very act of looking left or right creates significantly unpleasant side effects, right?
Yeah, and that has to do with one is that that's spinning fast enough to counteract the fact that you're being pulled down towards the Earth.
So this is okay. So it's the fact that there are two gravitational fields. Is there not an illness factor if you're in zero G?
It depends on the size of the diameter of the spin. If your feet are moving a hell of a lot faster than your head, you know, you get this sort of destabilizing, and that's why you want to have a larger, wider ring. And we've done like small scale tests with like Gemini craft on tethers and stuff. And, you know, there's a planned ISS project at some point to put a habitat and to sort of rotate it. The larger the ring, the easier, the less noticeable it is.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So when you get something that's got, you know, a 1,000-foot diameter, you know, and there's actually, like, you know, there's math to say if you have it this size or bigger and you're rotating at this speed, you're probably not going to have this noticeable effects. You know, when you get a much smaller ring, et cetera, then it's, yeah, these problems come into play, you know.
Two random thoughts, and this has nothing to do with anything we've talked about, but now, you know, since we seem to be on the subject of space today, when I in the late 80s, when I was a preteen, I was reading some magazine that talked about a plan there's that too. There was a plan by the French to celebrate some anniversary or other by inflating a giant ring in space that they claimed would be at times as bright as the full moon. And for whatever reason, it didn't happen. I assume that there's all kinds of international pressures, the fact that it would be essentially constant light pollution or whatever. But as we enter an age where there are fewer political detriments to doing that kind of thing, and as more of the power goes to private enterprises, like, number one, I'm surprised that in the year 2014, nobody has started shooting a laser light show that's secretly an advertisement onto the moon, or nobody has inflated a giant space ring to advertise something. Like, why has this not happened yet, and how long until it does, is, I guess, what I'm asking you.
Two reasons. One, to do the light show on the moon, you're still going to need a big, damn powerful laser.
Yeah.
And there have been like companies and stuff that have talked this thing around. Second, if you want to do the big reflector thing, you're going to get a lot of pushback from astronomers. And if you're going to have to go use one of the current companies to provide space light for this, you're going to, the negative reaction to it, you know, is going to be, because
you have to have somebody that will risk putting you up there to do that, like, considering the fact that they make their money with other people that might not like the fact that
we're doing
that.
Yeah, and you need to be sure you're going to be a good orbit partner. What you're going to put up there isn't going to interfere. And I'm not saying it's not going to happen, you know, but I think that's been, I've heard some stuff like Pepsi was thinking about doing something like that, and there'd been talks of trying to do that. And it wouldn't surprise me if, for propaganda purposes, the Chinese government decides to do something along those lines at some point. But, you know, the we're still at the phase of like, A, you know, if you're doing that just to be show off, and there are all these inherent risks, then you're kind of a jerk.
Yeah, but I feel like, and again, I'm trying to divorce it from the political, right? Because like political, if China were to even take the most innocuous message, let's say they wanted to put the Chinese symbol for peace on the moon or whatever, like at the end of the day, like they don't care that the message is peace. They care that it's a Chinese character on the MFing moon or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so there are political ramifications for that that'll cause big trade difficulties. But let's say Google wants to do, like, you know, hooray for the internet on the moon. They don't have as much.
But number one, can we just understand an amazing AdWords opportunity if they can put something up there on the moon?
Yeah, take a selfie and send it in to our Google contest, and your face will be on the moon. I guess now that we are more open to commercial opportunities in space than at any point in all of human history, I'm surprised that we haven't seen somebody lay down, you know, $20 million, $100 million, you know, $500 million to do something like this.
I think it's going to get more feasible and practical. The problem is, like, if you want to do something like deface the moon, you're going to risk the ire of, you know. Yeah, the fact that we put an American flag there, and only an American flag there, that you can't even see, upset people.
Well, and plus also, but keep in mind, it's, I mean, that American flag is still there and has always been there. We left trash on the moon, real trash on the real moon.
American trash.
A laser light show could be like a one-off opportunity where
it's a touchy subject. It is. All right. If you ever, let's say you mentioned we left trash on the moon. If you've ever lived in a condominium or a place with a public shared pool where it is everybody who is paying in to keep the pool nice, imagine that with the whole world times a billion. If you do something to affect the public Earth resource of the moon.
And technically, like, to paint the moon with a laser, like an Earth-based laser, you're talking about a death ray.
Sure. Okay. So try this on for size, though. Imagine a publicity event, right? Let's say 2 years from now, Google.
Ryan is opening Moon Marketing Inc.
That's right.
Brushwood subdivision.
Let's say sometime in the next 2 years, SpaceX gets their act together, and they're able to very, very cheaply start throwing stuff up into orbit. They start doing that. Google puts up its own satellite. Google says, hey, among other things, this satellite has a very powerful microwave laser, whatever. And they say, we are going to project on roughly something the size of we'll say not Africa, maybe half of Africa. I don't know, like South America.
Africa.
Half Africa. we're going to project an important message on a giant chunk of the moon. Now, you will barely be able to see it with the naked eye, but if you have even a modest telescope or a pair of binoculars, you'll be able to clearly read this message. We're going to do it for about, you know, two nights or whatever. Like that to me seems so small of an event that everybody would be okay with it, right?
I think that your reflector idea would be much. I mean, the amount of energy it would take to literally do that. You're talking the Navy doesn't even have a laser that could do that. You're talking a space-based death laser capable of doing that. That's the first thing people. Well, how bright is this laser? Because that's effing bright.
Okay. You know? All right. Let me give a different version. You know how on lasers you could put different filters on there that automatically separate the light into a shape or whatever. Imagine they do like a 3 mile by 3 mile film that takes sunlight and does the same kind of thing, right?
Sure.
The point is they spend a modest amount, and the end effect is that if you have a pair of binoculars or a telescope, you can see taking up about 5% of the visible surface of the moon.
Sure. Yeah.
A message.
And I think if they coach it with, and this is the valuable scientific thing we're going to do, you know, too. I think for people protesting, it'd be cool. A thing that I always thought would be cool when I was a kid was, you know, the displays that use the micro mirror arrays now, you know, for like television. So basically, like a lot of projection television now, what it is, it's a microchip and it has thousands of mirrors that either tilt one way or the other, right?
Wait, no, I don't know about this. Explain this to me.
Yeah, that's how like a majority now of a lot of your video projection systems
work. Oh, like DLP. DLP does like a spinning mirror thing.
Yeah, and so you have these little things, they either spin one way or they tilt or whatever, right? Imagine on the moon, we just cover the moon with reflectors. And we just turn the moon into a display.
Oh, my God. So you're saying just scatter all these and actually turn mirrors at us where each one oh, my God, there's no reason this couldn't work.
You know, you could, or you could just put it in space. You could have a series of reflectors. You could, if we built a, like the Navy's looking at right now, at building an array to be able to beam power down to specific points so they could power ships and other assets around the world without having to send refueling. Now, if you had this big, huge array with a bunch of individual discrete mirrors, you could also, hey, guys, let's turn it into a big TV screen.
And then you can just play something really inoffensive like Forrest Gump. Yeah. And you can translate it to all the different languages and we'll watch it. Run, Forrest, Run is trending on Twitter worldwide. What an amazing buy the world a Coke moment.
Can I tell you, like, the weirdest part is, as you suggested that, the first thing that popped in my mind was that, ooh, we're going to need a bigger population in order to justify that expense. We're going to need more eyeballs in order to pay for all of that.
I think if you're using it, it might be surprisingly cost effective. If you look at what we're looking, when you're talking about space-based reflectors, your thin Mylar sheets, you know, you take, you know, what the total output of Reynolds wrap for a year, foil might do it.
So here's a good question. And somebody was asking, like, okay, so we're playing around with these ideas. What does that mean for light pollution?
Oh, it's horrible.
And my gut says that we've already lost the war for light pollution, right? I mean, there's so much light pollution, but also it is kind of insignificant because we already have telescopes outside of the planet, in which case we get the valuable intel that any of us can access.
Most observations are still terrestrial based. And then there's that, do you want to cover up the chunk of the sky that it turns out that big asteroid's coming from?
Well, I mean, there's that, but it's like we're not gonna spot that asteroid with our eyes. We're gonna spot it with various space-based telescopes.
You're assuming, but again, how much of a lot of that Earth, that stuff is actually still terrestrial-based right now. Eventually, I think
I guess what I'm saying is like as the light pollution increases, I am assuming that the number of space-based telescopes will increase as well.
Totally agree. Yeah. And like that's like planetary resources. Their ARCID project is about doing it. I think with rapidly reusable spacecraft, you're going to get your local community college will be able to afford putting their own telescope up there and private. So, yeah. All right.
So how far away are we from getting our own telescope, guys?
The Weird Things Telescope.
Oh, the Weird Things Telescope.
Oh, side note, at the end of the tour, I took my buddy to, we went to the California Space Center and we saw the space shuttle Endeavor. And if you haven't had a chance to see one of these things up close, it is an amazing experience. Have you ever?
I want to say, I, and again, this is like a half-remembered thing. You know, I went to space camp, right? And in Huntsville, Alabama. And so I remember going around seeing all of the rockets. And that was as a kid. And then as an adult, I had a show at the University of Alabama, Huntsville. And it turns out that the guy that booked me worked, his fiance worked at the space camp. So I got to go revisit it where they had added like a Saturn V that you were able to walk all the way along and take a look at. I know I've seen the tiles, the heat tiles, mm-hmm. and I got in trouble for touching one because there were fiberglass, you know, components or whatever that might injure me. I don't think I have seen.
So what's neat is they have this in this big warehouse type building, and you walk in there and the thing's maybe elevated 10 feet off the ground. So you can walk underneath it. You can walk all around it. You get a good look at it and you realize how big this thing is, because this thing is, you know, it's 122 feet long. Okay. 122 feet long and it's, you know, 80 feet wide. Right. And this thing is big. This thing is just ginormous. And you sit there and you look at this thing and like, this is fatter than an airplane that I've been on. You know, this is fatter than an airplane. And this thing I'm looking up has been up in space. It's orbited. It's like docked with like, you know, ISS, et cetera. This is incredible. And then you think, and then it lands by gliding back to Earth.
You like, insane.
And you look at this.
Well, and the fact, like it makes me think of, again, there are legitimate criticisms to the entire space shuttle program. There's a reason that the Soyuz has never had a loss of craft. And yet, you know, the shuttle was a 2% failure rate or something ridiculous. But all that aside, if you watch the IMAX movie, Hail Columbia, it is such a triumph. I mean, it's not how we would do it. If we had it to do over again, there was a lot of compromises all the way through everything. There are difficulties and there's a good reason that the plan is being retired. But all that being said, in the 70s, they said, let's make a spaceship that we could keep using over and over again. And then they made a spaceship that they were able to keep using over and over and over again. That's really insane. Remarkable.
Yeah, there were two fatal Soyuz missions, but other than that, you know.
No. Not well. And keep in mind, I'm quoting Richard Garriott because when I was asking him if he was uncomfortable with the Soyuz, he said that the equipment there was a zero failure rate. But I don't know if it's like what I seem. What you're saying sounds familiar. But I believe it was like not related to its performance in space or something.
Soyuz 11 ended in disaster. The crew capsule depressurized during preparations for reentry, killing the 3-man crew.
Okay, so they died in space.
Soyuz 1.
Padre SJ is saying before 1971, there were two fatal accidents. But since then, I guess whatever the latest iteration is what Richard Gage was saying.
And the same, the latest iteration of the shuttle, we could say. So, no, Soyuz is a very reliable. Soyuz is a workhorse as a percentage of launches versus its most successful human spaceflight craft there is. Absolutely, absolutely true. And it's also designed specifically to do it's nowhere near the complexity of the shuttle was. And again, I will go on and on about the problems of the shuttle, a 60s era project with a 70s level design that was already antiquated by the time. And it was just the first one blew up because of pork barrel politics. You know, the second one was just because of bureaucratic oversight and all the inherent problems in that. Again, it's hard to compare the two because one is this humongous, massive thing that is the size of one of the largest airplanes you can conceive of and carries entire school buses back down to Earth. And the other one is a can that
right.
is, anyhow.
So where can people see a shuttle now?
In the Ukraine is that a lot more attention is being paid to the idea of having our own domestic, human transport to the space station in space outside of, you know, Russian launch.
That's crazy.
So where can people see a shuttle now? There's
one in LA, right? Discovery
one in LA. There's one in I think the Cape Canaveral Space Center. Trying to figure out where they all ended up.
But was if you there look one up, in DC? Did we see one in DC, or was it only there for a limited time?
Well, I know that there's. I guess the only remaining ones is you have Atlantis is still around somewhere. Endeavor's around somewhere. Discovery's around. I believe is Discovery in.
LA. I got it. I can tell you right now.
Okay, but then there's also the Enterprise. I know the Enterprise is the one that they built never to go into space, but just to prove that it could land and was you know. Compatible
Atlantis
with
Atlantis is on display at Kennedy Space Center.
Okay.
Challenger is in heaven. Columbia is in heaven. Discovery is at the Udvar Hazy Center in Virginia. It's in display in Virginia. The Enterprise, as you mentioned, the test is at the Intrepid in New York, which is the big aircraft carrier, which like every time I go to New York and I drive by there's like some big gay rave going on in this aircraft.
Can I say real quick about the Enterprise that one of my greatest memories of the Enterprise has nothing to do with the space program at all. It was
but it was instead a big gay rave on the Intrepid.
No, well, and this is the only reason I bring it up is because we're going off topic clearly. But there was some episode of Jeopardy I was watching, and I was 12 years old at the time. This chick was clearly way in first place. And they got to Final Jeopardy, and the question was, what was the name of the version of the space shuttle that never flew but was used for practice or whatever? And this chick was, like, so upset. She was shaking her head. She was so clearly screwed. And she wrote Enterprise as a joke. She wrote it as a joke.
Like, as, like, the Star Trek USS Enterprise.
Exactly. Like, whatever, the Enterprise. Turned out she got it totally right, won a bazillion dollars or whatever. And it was like, that to me was one of the most remarkable things I'd ever seen on television at the time.
Yeah. So there's also like The Adventure, which is just like a mock-up thing. So I'll tell you, the thing that surprised me looking at the Endeavor was how you look at the tiles, you get that, and you see them under there, and you see like there's like individual like hex nuts screwing each one in, and they're each numbered. And then you look up above the white area, the white tiles, it looks like it's caulked together with ceiling tiles, and it's just the most un-aerodynamic, unseemly thing. If I was making a movie about the shuttle and my prop department presented this to me, I would fire them. I'd be like, no, this is not space worthy.
But I guess that's the whole thing is that relative to the overall size of everything, it's plenty aerodynamic, I assume, right? It's sort
it
of
worked.
Like Europa, on the surface of Europa, there are giant cliffs and crags and giant canyons and so on. And yet, as a single object, I remember somebody telling me that and this may be totally wrong. I'm sure somebody will correct me, but Europa is the single smoothest marble ever created, known to man. Basically, was for all those giant jags up and down. There's not a handheld 2-inch marble that we could create that wouldn't be. I guess there probably would be. Now that I think about it, because you could, especially in free fall, you could take a liquid that's solidified. But at any rate, the point is like out of the entire size of the thing, those jags that look so big up close don't really affect it.
Right, gentlemen, I think we need to do one more weird thing.
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to save a couple of these things for next week. All right. I have an offer for you guys.
All right.
How would you guys like to take a vacation?
it seems to be a recurring theme. You know, we love vacations. We hate our lives.
I know you guys love vacation. Do you guys like Brazil?
Man, I'd say, well, a lot of time I look at my life and I'm like, this sucks, something awful. I want to do something other than this for a little bit and then go back to my terrible drudgery.
Right, but most importantly, whatever it is we do has to be in a location that's not where we are right now, because
God, yeah, no.
Clearly where we are is an inferior place on the planet. We need to go to a superior place.
Stinks like a pile of butts. Let's hit the bricks.
Working at the butt plant isn't our best job, Justin. I thought the money was good, but the methane factory wasn't where...
Working on some butt moves.
Joe, how would you like to visit the lovely Ilha de Cromeira Grande? It's a Brazilian island located 35 kilometers away from the coast of São Paulo.
State. In. Already in.
Number one, Brazil,
hot place. Got the World Cup coming up, the Olympics coming up the next year. They are balling out of control right now.
I've already packed my floral pattern shirts and my thong underwear, and I got two flip-flops on. I went ahead and I got some shots from just a random guy who said they would make me immune from everything in Brazil.
Yep. And those things include everything that happened in City of God and AIDS.
Right. Also, he gave me an extra shot, said that it would make me crocodile proof and piranha proof.
Listen, this island has got a steep terrain. It's nice. You've got some hills you can climb up onto. It's not a small island by any account. Let me take a look here. Give you a, it's 43 hectares. Okay. So,
how many acres is that?
43 hectares is more than 1 acre, as I remember from my metrics conversion. Let me tell you right now, 43 hectare. Let me go to Wolfram Alpha. And
so while you're doing the math on that, I feel like this is a great deal. Obviously, we are going to get I don't know if it's free, if we're paying. We probably should have agreed on a price before we immediately threw our lot in. But I assume this is at least a reduced kind of trip.
I would imagine there's some kind of value. You're not going to make us pay retail after all.
It's about the equivalent of Vatican City in land area.
Yeah. All right. That's big. Big enough.
It's nice. It's you can just traverse it in a day, walk around it and enjoy it.
I mean, we're not moving there, right? It's just a vacation. We got to be back at the butt plant next week.
Sure.
That's it. That's all. And I'm not going to charge you anything. I'm going to let you live there. So
yeah.
We're all good.
Man, I'm going to open up a little bed and breakfast, and we're going to fry up some eggs and plantains.
Just in case you have any concerns, just let me know what they are.
All right. So we get there. We find a nice little place. You wanted to be smart, right? So you go to shop at the supermarket before you arrive at the place you're going to stay. That way we can make some sandwiches. Mm-hmm. Brian, how you feeling so far on our little vacation?
Everything's 100% win, right? We go, we relax, we unplug, we high five each other, play a little volleyball, a little one on one.
There's one little first catch, it's a tiny little catch. I need to put you guys on my boat in the middle of the night because the Brazilian Navy won't actually let me bring you there if they know I'm doing it.
So we got to slip in under cover of darkness.
Yeah, I just got to do that.
That's fine.
Listen, Bri.
Covert.
Adventure tourism.
Dude, I get to take some shoe polish and put it on my face like I'm a spec ops.
No, let's stay away from that.
It's a bad idea. Okay, all right.
No, that's inappropriate, even for Brazil.
Do I get to come in like a fan man?
Wrecking ball.
With a giant paraglider that I come in on?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll get you on there. Now, the name in Spanish means the big burnt island.
It's not actually on fire.
No, it's not. It's not on fire.
No, I know what it's about.
That is a lie spread
big
by people.
Burnt island.
Oh, you get burnt. I see.
The fishermen tried to occupy it before by setting fires on it to clear cut, whatever, and that didn't succeed.
It's not still all burnt up.
What do we look like? A couple of Brazilian fishermen?
Yeah, come on, man.
Look, teeming with wildlife.
We're gonna set up.
That's great. We can bring one of those your nice cameras. We can take some photos.
We're gonna set up a laser tag park on the island. I feel like
I'll tell
Keep
you,
you
what.
On your
like
feet.
My family.
It's a great idea.
My aunt and uncle, they go down to Costa Rica all the time. They have a cute little monkey that jumps into their backyard. They feed it grapes. It's a hilarious time for everybody.
This is so far nothing I'm hearing is phasing us. I feel like I'll tell you what. Let me call Bonnie. We'll go ahead and juggle some things next week. Good for you, Justin.
Dude, I'm all over it.
All right.
I think this is a great choice. Any other questions? Any other hesitations? Just let me know.
I mean, all right. Let's just so I know. Fashion-wise, what to wear in the photos we're taking with the native wildlife so the color profiles aren't intensely clashing.
Good point.
What animals are on the island. You said teeming with wildlife. I just want to know what kind of photos we're looking for.
So you've got, there are birds, there are a lot of trees, there are a lot of birds in the trees.
I love birds.
Yeah.
So now the bird, how big of birds are we talking? Bigger than me?
No, these are like tropical birds.
Yeah, see, whatever. I could take a tropical bird. We can eat those. Justin, you ever eat a tropical bird? Might be rare.
I'll tell you what.
Have you ever eaten a meal that made a species extinct?
I've been on a cruise ship.
The birds, no, right. And then, you know, the other, you know, if you just sort of said what types of animals, you'd find the typical types of animals you would have on a Brazilian.
So what, you know, you get your birds, a couple, monkeys, a meerkat. What are we looking at?
We're not in physical danger, are we?
Lizards.
Man, that was a weird evasion. All of a sudden,
I missed something.
Man, he just got real thirsty. No. I said, are we in physical danger?
Okay, hold on. Wait
suddenly,
a minute.
Brian, we're always in physical danger.
But you really reacted.
Is there any history of death, human death, by way of animals on the island?
Maybe some legends and stuff. When you try to find a counting of it.
All right, so
is the legend of the hidden temple, Silver Snake?
All right, so if we were hanging out, talking to the locals, we shared a Lone Star beer around a campfire, what stories might the locals tell us about this area?
Well, there are no locals on this island.
Because they're all too smart. they're all steering clear.
You don't let anybody live. There is one legend, and again, it's a legend. It's not really well documented. You know, and one moment they're telling you, you know, about, you know, dinosaurs in the jungle somewhere else. And the next they're telling you this legend. You can't believe this is, you know.
Noise. I mean, it's all just noise.
Number one, and also, but I'd say this.
How stupid as I tell you.
All right, wait, well, hold on. Go ahead, Justin.
I'm just saying this. If there's no locals, then we only have to buy two of these brand new Don't Hassle Me, I'm Local Big Burnt Island t-shirts that I'm bringing for our vacation.
I'll tell you what, man. Print out a whole bunch. Set up a cafe press on that. Then anyone who visits us can take one home.
So they tried to burn the island, and it wasn't successful because
it's fireproof.
There's a reason why they maybe tried to burn the island, and that's why it got its name. And do you remember Jurassic Park 3?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, when I say, you know, the Navy won't let you go near an island.
Yeah.
It's either military base, maybe unexploded munitions, radioactivity, and then this other cause.
King Kong. Is it King Kong? Is it Skull Island?
Is it some kind of I don't know, like creature that they can't let get into the local ecosystem?
Well, the creature they don't want to let into the ecosystem's humans. So the legend has that the last island's inhabitants were a lighthouse keeper and his family. And one night, one of them entered through the window and attacked the man, his wife, and their children. They tried to escape with their boat, but from the branch injected them. They died before reaching the shore.
I'm sorry. Is there like a crazy
sounded
disease?
Sounded like there was a mumble there. Can you please restate what you just said?
I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it sounded like you said maybe there's like a disease rampant on the island. Is it a venom?
People with venom. This sounds like
what
the,
is the word venom mean
weird
to you?
Things end of snakes.
Wait a minute. Is there snakes there?
There's snakes on every island.
Oh, no. Not again. Brian, we've been hoodwinked yet again.
So,
the fatal flaw of the weird things scenario. There's
Eric
snakes
Meyer.
There.
Eric sent this to us. And the headline from Share After Reading, this island is so infested that it had to be quarantined by the government. And, you know, the new internet journalism followed by WTF.
So, wait, tell me this. So it boils down to they tried to set fire to an entire island just to get rid of all the snakes on it.
Okay, because you see, it has two names. It's Isla de Comera Grande. All the Spanish-speaking people out here, Portuguese-speaking people are upset with me. nicknamed Snake Island, is a 430,000 square meter island off the coast of the state of Sao Paulo, Brazil. It is home to a species of Fertilance, the golden lancehead viper, which is one of the most venomous snakes in the world. Local legend claims there are five snakes to every square meter.
No.
Whoa. But the Discovery Channel said that's ridiculous, and they said that it's maybe only about one snake per square meter.
Oh, God.
It's the only species of snake on the island. It is heavily inbred, heavily hungry, and apparently, like, this island is riddled with snakes, and it climbs trees despite having that snake prehensile tail that apparently other snake tree climbing snakes has. It eats birds. It eats everything. This venom is pretty damn dangerous. So, yeah, it's called Snake Island.
This is a terrible vacation.
Actually, I'm still down for it. I say, really? Well, I mean,
he's going to put on a couple galoshes. Maybe a little rubber bathing suit.
Yeah, exactly. I'm gonna show up in like I'm gonna visit a blacksmith, and I'm gonna show up in full armor, and it's just gonna go chink chink when it tries
Smithy,
to bite me.
Smithy, hammer me out a suit for Snake Island.
Come, let us go on a walk. Shunk 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 shunk.
Take these two coppers. The only inhabitant
was a lighthouse keeper. Fling, fling. And like. Want to talk about a suck job.
All right, no, let's talk about this for real. So, not so great as a vacation. How no. much would you charge? I'm a crazy Monopoly man shows up and says, "Your job, Justin, Andrew, is to go experience 48 hours on this island. You have virtually no you can provision yourself with $1,000 of whatever, but you have no shelter. You just have to go and live and be there. How much would you charge?" And understand, this is not like in theoretical. This is like in reality. Like, you could pull out your iPhone, you can record blog posts, you could tell this story. So there's some value to this amazing experience. How much would you want to go do this?
Unless I can get, like, I guess sometimes scientists go there and they get waivers. I don't know how far in they go. Did you watch Riddick?
No, I did not.
I haven't seen it yet. No.
All right. I heard it was pretty much the Pitch Black, right? It was pretty much that again.
So yeah, it was like I could watch 1,000 of those movies.
I agree.
So there was this guy down in Florida whose blood they would use for anti-venom because he'd been bitten by so many snakes, survived it, that he actually produced. He's one of these produced a good anti-venom. So he's one of these people. Wow. He could get bit by rattlers and other snakes and walk it off. So you can develop resistance to these things. Getting to that point is a challenge.
Sure.
I would have to figure out what is, and I don't know if I could afford to get to there for $1,000, but like, you know, I'm looking like this is, I'm probably going to die here.
Really?
I mean, Brian, it's a snake every square meter.
I know.
Apparently the venom is something that killed people before, like, normally, if you get bitten, let's say snakes are in your house and you need to get to a boat to get off the island, like, your danger is in you, like, just can't get back to land fast enough. Like, you know, maybe if the venom is super, super toxic. And that happened to not one but three people, according to that legend.
Right.
Like, this is extraordinarily potent venom and apparently a bazillion snakes.
All right. So, so what's your fee, Justin Robert Young, to take a week off from your regular gig? And
let me explain. 90% of Brazilian snake bite related fatalities are due to this genus of snake. Okay. The golden lancehead occupy this island. They get over half a meter long. They have a fast acting poison that melts the flesh around the bite.
Jeez. All right. Well, that affects my price. What is your price, Justin? 48 hours, 2 days.
2 days?
And you're decently provisioned. You got $1,000 or however much of your own money you want to spend. Like, you can, and I know there's no cheap anti-venom or whatever, but you can, I don't know, you can put on stuff that.
I can't just park a boat. I mean, like, just like look out.
Marcelo Duarte, a biologist who's visited Snake Island over 20 times, says that the locals' claim of 1 to 5 snakes per square meter is an exaggeration, though perhaps not by much. One snake per square meter is more like it. Not that it should ease one's mind. At one snake per meter, you're never more than 3 feet away from death.
40 grand, I'm going to go.
But what? You don't even get a full year's salary out of like a roll of the dice you expect to die trip?
Two days, and I figure you could probably put on like a triple thick like leather, some kind of bite-proof pants.
Understand. I think with this one, there's no shame in getting underbid. Right? Like, you're just naming your price, and then if somebody else wants to come in, you're not competitively bidding for 48 hours on Snake Death Island, right?
I would say very quickly, if someone comes in and be like, 30 grand, bro, I'm there, I'd be like, you know what? Maybe he's the better man for the job.
Listen, man, you gotta know when to hold him, know when to fold him.
Exactly.
Know when to walk away from Snake Island for less than an average salary in
San Francisco. Would you really not do it for 40,000?
No.
But like you can.
That would not be my bid. And if somebody offered it to me, I would not do it. No.
Really? Wait, you would full up? Wow, that's amazing.
No. Brian, I could die.
What part of death do you not understand?
Well, you could die doing anything. You could die. All of a sudden, I turn into Andrew trying to sell us on the island. He's like, you're always in danger. There's snakes everywhere.
I'm not doing it for less than those crazy people do for, like, you know, ice road trucking or crab fishing in Alaska or whatever, where there's like a high death rate.
48 hours? First of all, you could pretty much like rent a spacesuit and just waddle around in your snake-proof spacesuit for 48 hours.
You only gave us a $1,000 budget, by the way.
Well, okay, no, outside of that, you would spend your own money. And in which case, like...
So now you're doing it for less than 40,000.
Well, yeah. But I'm safer.
Why?
I got to imagine there's
if I am doing it, and if I am honestly being made to consider to do it, I have to leave enough money that it would affect the lives of my friends and family and those that I know. That if I were to die, at least it would be money that would better their lives, which is more than 40,000.
Well, I mean, you could buy an insurance.
40,000 happens, you know, like more often, like, you know, grandma dies and the family has to split 40,000 or something like
sure.
that.
Sure. Wow, this is amazing. Because number one, like, to me, there's some value in just having the adventure of going and doing it. And 40,000 is enough that I will get off my butt and go do it and have the adventure and take care of myself.
But this is not like, oh, like the amazing vistas and like the gorgeous.
No, it's even better.
Waterfalls. It's just stand on a rock where death encircles you and hope that what you have built up as your barriers to death hold, that your levees hold, and instead the flood of instant perishing does not breach.
I bet there's at least one listener to the Weird Things podcast right now who will probably email us, who's very familiar with snake handling, very familiar with snake protection processes or whatever, and finds us horrifically
smart for avoiding them.
No. Someone out there is just like, I'll do it for $500 and three tacos.
But the question is not, are there people that will do it, right? Because there are people that will do anything. The people that will do that for free.
That's true.
Because of the adrenaline that comes along with being that close to death.
Yeah.
The idea is for us, as completely untrained and unskilled in this position, if we were to, like, all of a sudden that hits Craigslist and it says, please email your bids to idiots@snakemountain.org. EDU.
I don't know. I would be interested what number would you reconsider at, Justin?
We're the low end is I'd have to, and I'm up against it to do my taxes like this week. I'll look at what I have made and project it out for the next year, and that's the minimum. The minimum is a year's salary.
A whole year's salary just to go and hang out?
To put your, I mean, like, again, this is not a thing where I will get anything out of it except for just being close to death.
Huh.
And at that point, you might as well just ingest poison, as much poison as you can over a 48-hour period and, like, survive it and take money, right? Like, it's not a beautiful place. It's literally just rocks and dirt and sand and snakes.
So for you, a year's salary. What about you, Andrew?
I don't know enough to risk. I would want to talk to, you know, a researcher who's been there and be like, all right, listen, what do I got to do? Like, oh no, the snakes are actually really scared of you and they only like people wear suntan lotion. And be like, oh, okay, done. But if you wear a spacesuit, they will just attack you in mass.
Yes.
And these are tree climbing snakes, by the way, Brian.
Yeah. I mean, look, I get that it'll be complicated and a big deal. I get that, right?
So what's your price? What's your lowest price?
Well, Brian's doing it for $30 and a Hardee's hamburger. Yeah,
well, for 40 grand and I'm building some. I mean, because think about it. Like, I'll spend $100 on a grenade that'll you know, throw snake poison out in the area or whatever. I'm getting like a rebreather. It's like a full body suit. I'm going to be wearing like a still suit from Dune where I'm totally like I'm pooping on the inside and then recycling.
Okay, everything. So, you know, like your initial, like you get $1,000, but then you can get paid any amount to go do this. You kind of negated the whole $1,000 limit because I could say, oh, $1 million. I'll spend $500,000 on buying the metal undersea suit.
I know, but you won't get it because I've already undercut you for $40,000. Yeah.
No, Brian, I'm taking out an insurance policy on your life and letting you do this.
All right, fair enough.
Brian, all right, so deal. Snake Island has accepted your deal for $40,000. I'm giving you 5 hours. The over-under is 5 hours before you find yourself straight Muldooned, like crouched in the bush, looking to your left because you think you've avoided the snake, seeing a big fat snake in your face going, clever girl, and then boom.
Fair enough.
Corpse. Is
let's
being
find out.
Dragged off the island,
and thus we launch the Weird Things Patreon and to send Brian
way,
to Snake Island.
The chat room here, Brian.
What's that?
I think everybody thinks you're flat out nuts.
That's fair. I mean, like, I may be, but I don't know. $40,000. I mean, understand the people who died, they were doing it for $40, not $40,000. They were just there because there was $40 worth of stuff around. And it's like,
what you're saying,
and they had no protection.
So listen, there's somebody in the chat room whose name handle is Pro Snake Handler.
All right. I'm pretty sure. Actually, I would like to point out that's Brant. that's my number one Brant there.
Well, listen to Brant.
Fair enough.
I like the idea of professional snake handler. Like, no, I don't work for science.
None of this amateur business.
No, parties, children's parties.
You guys want to do picks?
Let's do picks.
I guess I just have to double down on. It wasn't even my pick last week. It's just what I was up to last week. I mentioned that I started rereading Name of the Wind, but I've mega doubled down because after listening to it, I was like, I think my 10-year-old daughter can handle this. So I've got Penny listening to the audiobook. This is the first time she's ever listened to an audiobook. She's 10 years old now. And I am almost done with the follow-up, The Wise Man's Fear.
These are the King Killer Chronicles?
Yep, that is exactly correct. Written by Patrick Rothfuss, expertly told on audiobook by Nick Podell. Man, is it good. It is really, really good, and I'm really enjoying reading it for a second time. I can't say enough good stuff about it. I know that he's got some kind of novella that he's working on in that universe, and then after that, you know, it'll be, what, like a half decade until we get the final book, but man, is it good. I so very much enjoy it, and I recommend everybody else listen to it.
Well, my pick is, and I watched this a few weeks ago, every now and then I go through a little bit of a kick and I decide I want to go watch something of a genre. And I realized I'd never seen this film before, even though I'm a big Clint Eastwood fan.
Mm-hmm.
And that is High Plains Drifter.
I've never seen it. I am only familiar with the Beastie Boys song.
Same thing. High Plains Drifter was directed by Clint Eastwood, and it certainly had the influences of, you know, having worked with Sergio Leone, but it also had, it's Clint Eastwood, when he's taken the, you know, the Man with No Name character, of which, you know, Stephen King, when he created the Gunslinger a trilogy series, used, you know, was very influenced by the idea of watching this character and the idea of sort of this Western fantasy-esque persona. I had no idea how much Eastwood had embraced the idea of almost the mystical, magical elements of that. And if you watch High Plains Drifter, very, very evident in there. And, you know, Eastwood's take on that, between that and then later on when he did Pale Rider, and his idea of, you know, who this character really is takes on a mystical connotation to it. And High Plains Drifter is kind of a very trippy movie, and I enjoyed it thoroughly.
Can you tease some of the mystical elements of it, unless you think that it would spoil it?
I would say that, like, you're used to the idea of the lawman showing up in town to save the town, but the premise here is the lawman shows up in town and it's an evil, wicked town that needs to be punished. And it's the idea of the avenging angel or avenging ghost, essentially, kind of concept. And that's what made me want to go, oh, I gotta go watch this, because it's not just, hey, it's a Western, it's him looking at, like, this is almost a religious allegory, etc. And it takes place, he shot it, I think it was like Lake Mono or whatever, Mono Lake, which is this really weird kind of, looks like, you know, almost this Planet of the Apes sort of environment. So he went for this very, doesn't look like any other kind of location you've seen in a Western before. It looks almost like an alien landscape to it. It's very, when he first shows up in town, the things that happen are, you know, what he does is it's great, classic kind of Clint Eastwood, and the character is very interesting. But if you look at it, like, it is almost a biblical narrative of this, what happens when he shows up. It's pretty neat.
Right on. And so, specifically, it would be which movie specifically you said?
High Plains Drifter.
All right.
And I mean, Netflix. Yeah, I mean, it, at one point it involves him having him painting the entire town red and writing the word hell on a sign when people come in.
All right. So my pick is Ashley got a Fit. Somebody bought her, a friend of hers bought her a Fitbit Force for Christmas. And whoever the person that they bought it from accidentally sent to. So I got a Fitbit Force, or at least I was going to. Ashley wanted to see whether or not she could trade it in. They wound up having a recall of them, so now they are no longer sold, this model of it. So I was like, well, too bad. I guess I won't get a Fitbit Force, because this one was the smallest possible, and my manly wrist certainly would not accommodate such a delicate lady Fitbit. And as it turns out, it fits very snug on my wrist, because I have delicate, very genteel, feminine wrists.
I mean, a lot of people don't know that, but the first time we met in 2008 at Halloween Horror Nights, I was like, hello, Justin Robert Young. Those are delightful, ladylike wrists.
You were catcalling and stomping your foot on the ground as I...
Which felt a bit inappropriate.
As only my wrist was revealed from around the corner, and you're like... Check out the wrist on that one. Like,
and I kept asking you what time it was, just so you would kind of pull back a bit of your long sleeve shirt, and I would, salaciously lick my lips and be all like, "Oh!"
Like, my head was eventually revealed, and you were like, "Meh, meh." Like,
but I was really awkward. I kept asking you to wear a bag over your head and just show me your wrist.
Just show me your wrist real quick. Just the wrist.
No, seriously, right, show us the wrist, Justin.
So I've been wearing the Fitbit Force. It's interesting. I'm not somebody that would describe oneself as interested in this new fitness craze of the quantifiable self and tracking footsteps and calories and stuff like that. I know a lot of people are. A lot of people enjoy it. It has been an interesting experience so far. I have enjoyed having it. I have found myself taking stairwells where I would not otherwise, just to kind of see that number go up. There is certainly something to that psychology of understanding where you're at and wanting to do slightly better because of it. I don't know whether or not I've really lost any weight, but I will say this. And this is a very specific use case. I wake up very early a lot to catch flights, like I did this morning. I woke up in the very room that Andrew is in right now in Los Angeles and flew to San Francisco, waking up at like 6 in the morning, and it often is very earlier than that, so I can get to SFO super early in the morning. It has a silent alarm on it, And you don't have to reach over and hit a button or hit your phone. It's always on you. So it has been a really cool and interesting way to not bother Ashley in the morning when I have to wake up super, super, super early. So I like that. I don't know whether or not it's worth, I got it for free, so I don't know whether it's worth the money, but I've enjoyed having it.
Oftentimes when I'm on a short schedule and it's important that I make it to the airport or whatever, I have a difficult time falling asleep if I'm not utterly confident that I will wake up with the alarm. That's part of the reason I set like two, even three alarms. If I'm in a hotel, I'll set two alarms and then also ask the front desk to call and so on. Like, yeah. You are confident that the buzzing on your wrist wakes you up?
Yeah. Far more than the audio element. You know, I think like you were relying on how there's always the fear that you are sleeping too deep to hear stuff, where I think if somebody were just jiggling your wrists violently, would usually wake up, you know, at a certain point. So I've found it is at 100% success rate for me. Not that waking up in the morning has necessarily been a hard element. I usually only set one alarm anyway, but at least this way, you know, it's like, it's one of those things where like my alarm will go off and then I'll try to stop it, but I'll actually snooze it instead of, you know, turning it off, and then it'll go off again in 5 seconds. It's kind of annoying, but this has been good. I've enjoyed it. Who knows whether or not I'll lose weight with it. But that's what it is. The Fitbit Force, and you can't buy it because apparently it leaks hot snake venom and burns your hand off.
Made on this island off the coast of Brazil by snakes.
By Brian Brushwood, who's apparently making $40,000 during his stay.
Like, wait, like per day? No. Just once.
Brian, your homework for next episode is I want you to run this theory by Bonnie.
I will. I actually will. In fact, maybe we'll have Bonnie show up for a segment next week and we'll talk it out.
Yeah. That would $40,000. There was I don't know if I told this story on the podcast, but I had a situation. It was probably the first time I've had a domestic situation like that. Like that is akin to Brian. We're hiring somebody at the Go Game for the job that I have. And I felt very strongly about one of the candidates. And I was like, listen, hire her if you need to fire me. And I kind of kept saying that as like to show how much I felt one of the candidates was better than the other one. And I told that to Ashley and she's like, can you please stop asking to get fired? Like, your income is a crucial element to our lives. Can you please stop?
This is what happens like, when you're
willy-nilly putting it in danger as a figure of speech.
This is the figures of speech that come out once you're drunk with the success of the Night Attack Patreon.
No, I don't even think it's necessarily that. I think it was me just being the I don't know if you guys have picked up on this, but I am prone to hyperbole and loud, bold statements. And that was kind of just an element of that. No kidding. I actually don't want them to fire me. I would be very upset if they fired me.
Now that that's cleared up.
Smash cut to the entire staff at the Go Game sitting around watching this live stream live as it happens.
Well, gentlemen, it's been weird.